Hello and welcome to the Diabetes Therapy Podcast. You are listening to the first podcast in our Diabetic Neuropathy Collection. My name is Victoria Glasson and I'm the editor for the journal. And today we will be speaking to Dr. Usman Alam, Senior Clinical Lecturer and Honorary Consultant at Liverpool University Hospital and an esteemed member of the Diabetes Therapy Editorial Board.
Thank you, Victoria. I'm, as you've stated, a Senior Clinical Lecturer and Honorary Consultant at Liverpool University Hospital. My background is very much in diabetic neuropathy and lower limb disease in diabetes, and I'm really eager to speak about diabetic neuropathy today.
Fantastic, Usman. Thank you. So to start off, could you please tell us what is diabetic neuropathy?
Sure. So diabetes affects the peripheral nervous system, and essentially diabetic neuropathy is a disorder of the peripheral nervous system which occurs due to the underlying diabetes and leads to peripheral nerve dysfunction. And it's actually the commonest complication of diabetes, and it affects anywhere up to 50% of people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. In fact, looking at the prevalence studies out there, there's even suggestions it may affect a lot more.
And what are the signs and symptoms that people should look out for?
So the commonest symptoms tend to be those that are sensory in nature. So patients can often complain of pain and can also complain of other kinds of what we call positive symptoms. Those are symptoms of pain and, for instance, burning. They can complain of shooting pain. So these are the typical positive symptoms. Then we have the negative symptoms, which actually tend to be, again, distributed in the same area, which can occur in a glove and stocking distribution in the distal areas, in the feet and the hands. The negative symptoms often can be comprised of numbness kind of feelings or sensations. So those are the initial symptoms that people can complain of, but as the disease progresses, then you can get what we call motor involvement. And that is actually weakness. And you can get weakness that occurs in more distal areas, but it can also occur more proximally with the progress of time and as symptoms progress. And on the flip side of this, there's also autonomic symptoms as well. And these tend to only present quite late on in the disease course. When I mean autonomic symptoms, I mean those that may involve the cardiovascular, gastrointestinal or genitourinary systems, and including sweat glands. Autonomic symptoms tend not to occur in the early stages of autonomic neuropathy.
And what is the most common type of diabetic neuropathy?
So this would be diabetic peripheral neuropathy, also what is known as distal symmetrical polyneuropathy. So this is what I've mentioned before, the glove and stocking distribution of neuropathy or nerve damage. And this tends to be the commonest form, although autonomic neuropathy is extremely common as well.
And how is diabetic neuropathy prevented?
Sure. So I'm going to have to split this into really thinking about diabetic neuropathy in terms of type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. So in type 1 diabetes, we've shown that actually having really good glycemic control can prevent or actually halt the progression of diabetic neuropathy. But the jury is somewhat out with type 2 diabetes, and a number of studies have actually shown that glucose control by itself may not affect the prevention or the progression of diabetic neuropathy. So in type 2 diabetes, we really think of this as more of a multifactorial kind of treatment. So, but in general, we should be telling our patients to control the diabetes and to try to improve the cardiovascular risk covariates, including the lipids, triglycerides, hypertension. There's some data which suggests that if you're heavier, you might have more painful symptoms. So again, those individuals with type 2 diabetes is really improvement in the weight. Again, diet and exercise, avoid excess alcohol. And of course, it's really one of the most paramount things we can ask them to do is to stop smoking as well.
Can you take us through the reasons why some people have pain despite a normal examination or no signs of neuropathy?
So we need to think about the actual nervous system itself when we think about those people that have a normal examination and have no signs of neuropathy, but they're still complaining of symptoms and pain. So, for instance, either burning pain or even numbness. So the peripheral nervous system comprises of A alpha, A beta, A delta fibers, and also C fibers. And it's the C fibers, or what's also known as the small nerve fibers, that are affected first. And these are the ones that are involved in the generation of pain and are related to symptoms, including that of burning. So when we think about people who have diabetic neuropathy, it's not just those individuals that have quite severe disease with large fiber involvement, but it's those that actually have small fiber deficits. So this can actually cause some quite considerable amounts of symptoms and pain despite having a normal examination.
So why can diabetic neuropathic pain be worse at night?
So diabetic neuropathy pain is worse at night, and this is quite typical of neuropathic pain itself. So that's neuropathic pain, which can involve other areas of the somatosensory system. Why the pain is worse at night still remains relatively unknown, although it was first described by Frederick William Pavey in the 1900s. There has been some suggestion that there may be involvement in the locus coeruleus, which is thought to play a part in pain, but also sleep. But it remains unknown. What we do know is that there is increasing pain sensitivity later on in the evening and at night, and previous studies have shown this.
So does this impact on sleep?
So it does have an impact on sleep, and people can often complain of waking up in the night with painful symptoms, and I see this quite often in my clinic. So imagine if you're in pain, and the pain is worse at the time when you're trying to go to sleep. And not only that, it wakes you up at night. This can often be quite debilitating, can have a major impact on the quality of life of our patients.
Is there a relationship between mood or depression and painful diabetic neuropathy?
Well, we just need to think about sleep itself. I've mentioned that sleep can be impaired. If you're not sleeping very well and you're in chronic pain, then you tend to have a worse mood and you're more likely to be depressed. Now, unfortunately, if you are depressed or have a low mood, then you're more likely to have painful symptoms. So this can be somewhat of a vicious cycle, which if you can break the cycle, then you can get improvements in both the mood and the pain. There was a study which was published in 2005 by Gore et al., which quite clearly showed that the increasing levels of pain, then the more likely to have anxiety and also depression, and the higher levels of these. So really, the more pain you're in, the more likely people are to have anxiety and depression.
And which autonomic dysfunctions must be managed in patients?
So it's really important for us to understand that autonomic dysfunction can occur relatively early on in the disease course, and it can have a major impact on the quality of life. So the one major autonomic dysfunction that can occur is erectile dysfunction, and it's really important that we ask male patients about erectile dysfunction, and this can have a major effect on the quality of life. Also, there's gustatory sweating, and there are treatments which are available, which are off-label for gustatory sweating. I often use glycopyrrolate paste or solifenacin or even oxybutynin to try to get some improvement in gustatory sweating. And it can have a major impact on the quality of life. Imagine if you're going out on a family meal or a meal with friends, and as you eat, you're just profusely sweating. It can have major implications in social exclusion.
Is there a way that we can reverse autonomic neuropathy?
So there are some data to suggest that autonomic neuropathy can be reversed in the early stages. Once you've got to orthostatic hypotension, or where people are having postural hypertension, then it's quite late on in the disease. So then it's not really reversible. But there is some data to suggest that there can be some reversibility, particularly with diet and exercise. Unfortunately, we don't have any treatments that affect the pathogenesis of diabetic neuropathy or even autonomic neuropathy.
And what happens to the quality of life for patients?
Well, we just need to imagine the various aspects of diabetic neuropathy. So one I've mentioned, pain. There's the other comorbidities that include anxiety, depression, and also lack of sleep or sleep interference. And this would all affect people's quality of life, and it can be really quite detrimental.
What kind of information should people suffering with diabetic neuropathy be given?
So we should really be educating patients on all aspects of diabetic neuropathy. So this includes really importance of glycemic control in addition to improving their cardiovascular risk covariates. The early stages of diabetes, it's really important to try to achieve good control of glycemia and also to modify any risk factors. Importantly, we should be telling people to stop smoking if they smoke. And if people do have diabetic neuropathy and subsequently have symptoms of pain, then they do need to be informed that we're unlikely to achieve 100% pain relief with any treatment. And at best, what we were aiming for is 50% pain relief. But as a part of our consultation, we should be counselling patients in regards to all these various factors.
Is there anything that we can do to prevent neuropathic diabetic foot ulcers?
That's an excellent question. So diabetic neuropathy is the strongest risk factor for foot ulceration and amputation in people with diabetes. So as a rule of thumb, those individuals that do have diabetic neuropathy, more so and particularly those that have severe neuropathy, need to undergo daily foot examinations. Those that have insensate feet and a lack of sensation really need to emphasise the importance of foot care and protection, not to walk barefoot. They need to consider how they trim their toenails and to do this with great care and actually have podiatry input for this. And of course, think about foot hygiene and look out for any kinds of infection in the feet. And again, another really important aspect is the need for wearing well-fitted shoes and not to wear sort of hard-soled shoes where they're walking long distances in this. And of course, it's trying to gain advice on footwear early on.
And what are the main risk factors for developing diabetic neuropathy? Is age a big factor?
So age is a risk factor, but that is somewhat in relationship to the duration of the diabetes. So the longer the duration of diabetes, then the more likely you are to have diabetic complications or diabetic neuropathy. So you can say as a rule of thumb by about 25 years of duration of diabetes, about half the population with 25 years of duration will have a diabetic neuropathy. There have been other associated factors such as hypertriglyceridemia, hypertension, weight, which have all also been linked to diabetic neuropathy.
We are going to be discussing diabetic neuropathy treatments in depth in another podcast, but can you quickly talk us through the treatments for different types of neuropathy?
So the mainstay of treatment for all the diabetic neuropathies, whether this is autonomic, distal symmetrical, or even if it's another form of diabetic neuropathy, is really to try to improve glycemic control along with the cardiovascular risk factors. And of course, stopping smoking, which I've said on a number of occasions, but that remains really the mainstay of therapy in trying to prevent or trying to halt the progression. And now each individual type of neuropathy will have its own treatment. So for instance, diabetic peripheral neuropathy, we've talked about pain, and we will be talking about pain relief in terms of antineuropathic agents. But for instance, with autonomic neuropathy, we need to consider the various aspects of autonomic neuropathy, whether this is cardiac autonomic, whether it's erectile dysfunction, or say, for instance, gastroparesis. And we treat each of those for symptoms, really. So erectile dysfunction, you can consider phosphodiesterase inhibitors or other kind of erectile dysfunction measures. Again, testosterone can be low in people with erectile dysfunction, so this may be something that we'd need to look at on an individual basis, particularly in people with type 2 diabetes. Gastroparesis can be quite difficult to treat, and there's a number of different therapies that can be used, but these are mainly off-label. And cardiac autonomic neuropathy, again, is generally quite asymptomatic in the early stages and only becomes symptomatic later on. But if we're thinking about orthostatic hypotension, then there's all the various therapies that are available for the treatment, which include fludrocortisone, midridine, and again, other off-label therapies such as pyridostigmine and ephedrine, as well as abdominal binders.
Finally, you've mentioned counselling for patients. Is this something that patients do have access to and that they can utilise?
Sure. So when I say counselling of patients, I mean, this is counselling within our own clinics. And this is something that each clinician should be doing. So what are the expectations that each patient has, and what are we able to do for the patient in terms of these expectations? We should be counselling patients on every time we meet them in clinic. But in terms of formal psychology counselling, the access to this can be quite variable, actually. So it depends on where you work, particularly within the UK. So I'm quite lucky we have access to specific pain counsellors and psychologists, and also diabetes psychologists. And they are actually a really very helpful resource and should be utilised when needed. So I tend to refer people who are having management problems with their diabetes, and in particular those that are in quite severe pain as well. I'll refer to the pain psychologists, and patients have received quite significant benefits from seeing these individuals.
Osman, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. As I mentioned at the start of the podcast, we will be releasing another 2 podcasts in our diabetic neuropathy collection, focusing on diagnosis and then another focusing on treatment. Again, Osman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Victoria.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Rapid Plus podcast with your preferred podcast provider, or by visiting the website.